This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Monday, time for our Zoomer Squad. And there really is just one big story. The breakdown of trade talks and this morning's escalation, at least a big escalation in the war of words. So just tacking back, initial reaction to the late Friday news ranged from people who believed that this was a total catastrophe to those who were more moderate, who said, hey, the tariffs that took effect after midnight only affect 5% of our economy, so we can manage that unless there's an escalation, which there certainly seems to be. So as you heard in Chris's news this morning, Donald Trump threatened a 50% tariff on all our vehicles and vehicle parts starting in the new year. And here's a yet another insulting tweet. Canada will be treated like a state no longer on trade and in other ways. Also, they are among the worst nations in the world to deal with. They feel entitled. And in caps, we don't need Canada. Canada, they need us. Well, then you heard our resident bad cop, Doug Ford's reaction in Chris's news.
Well, he can kiss my ass as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I wasn't even sure you could say that on the radio. And that was not the first reaction that seemed to come straight from the schoolyard.
You know, let me tell you about President Trump. President Trump is the type of person that would steal your lunch money the first day. He'd steal the toque off your head the second day, and the third day he'd steal your running shoes. He is not to be trusted whatsoever. We need to stay united.
Meanwhile, earlier, their very professional trade representative, Jameson Greer, did mention the possibility of getting back to the table, and I would not be surprised if their people and our people have already talked quietly since the breakdown. But I have to say, I'm with the majority of Canadians who feel we're not going to take this anymore. We're going to fight. But that comes a lot with this kind of anxious feeling in the pit of my stomach. So the numbers, 866-740-4740. That is our text line, our long distance phone line, 416-360-0740.
And now, time for the Zoomer Squad.
And now I'd like to welcome Bob Richardson, a public affairs consultant, Lauren Bozanoff, president and CEO of Foreign Research, and Karen Stintz, a longtime contributor here and a former city councillor and TTC chair. Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Libby. Hi, Libby.
Okay, I'm going to start with Lauren, because it looks like a majority of Canadians are saying you go to Mark Carney's announcement that talks were off, that we were at war. Lauren, have people always felt this way, or what are you reading into these numbers, and what are the numbers?
Well, the numbers are huge, actually. It's over 70% are saying they'd rather walk away than have a bad deal. So that came out about 10 days ago, actually, and I'm sure this qualifies as a bad deal. So we're at least in the 70% range in terms of public opinion.
And do you think that is likely to hold, or when we start feeling the pain, are people going to cry uncle?
You know what? It's all good until people start losing their jobs, right? And then we'll see how everyone feels. But right now, this has made everyone, I think, you know, more determined to get a good deal rather than to capitulate.
Okay, Bob, and you know, over last weeks and months, I've often criticized the Prime Minister for not being tough enough. So I have to say, I did like to see him being tough, but there are a lot of unanswered questions. Bob, how do you see this?
Well, there's a lot of unanswered questions. Welcome to a trade negotiation. It's going to remain like that for the next while. I mean, I think the Prime Minister has got a lot of support at the moment. I think he did a very good job on the weekend. I think he was strong. He was comprehensive. He showed a little bit of anger, which I think reflected the public mood. And my understanding is they worked hard. They were up till 3 a.m. Crafting things, and went to bed, and then we're up again at 6 getting ready for Saturday's press conference. So these guys have been at it kind of 24/7 for the last week. So I would suspect, not in the best mood for antics from our friend down south. I think the other thing that's important is he has very strong public support. 95% of Liberal voters thought he did the right thing. 75% of Bloc voters thought he did the right thing. I think about 65% of New Democrats. The only one where there's a split is among Conservative voters. There is a part of Conservative voters that are kind of hard right-wing, more MAGA-ish, and about 45% of Conservative voters thought he did the right thing. So that means he's carrying a lot of Canadians, a lot of Canadian support, and it gives him some flexibility as he moves forward.
Okay. Karen, you know, when this first broke, I thought I'd go back and look up and remind myself of what the road back was for the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, after that very nasty public dressing down. And one of the first things that struck me was that his people were in touch in back channels, like on the very same day. I think I've even seen some hints that that's what's already happening. Our countervailing tariffs that the Prime Minister has threatened are set to take effect on Labor Day or just after Labor Day, which gives us a 2-week window. And even our old hand, Ralph Goodale, says, hey, that's an opportunity to get back to the table. How do you see that?
Well, so I'm going to be in the minority here, and I'm okay with that. But you know, the challenge that I see now for our Prime Minister and our country actually is that how do we get to a deal? Because you know, part of the opportunity I think we've missed over the last year is explaining that the issue about the dairy and the irritants about the dairy market, that actually shouldn't be an American issue. That should be a Canadian issue for us to solve. And the reality is we're hurting ourselves because we have a marketing border in dairy and we pay more for dairy. And so, but we didn't address that issue. And now it's what the Americans want when it really should be what Canadians should be striving for. You know, with respect to the alcohol on the shelves, yeah, no, everyone feels good about pulling off the Kentucky bourbon and the California wine. And I understand that emotion. But the reality is we're in violation of our own trade agreement when we pull those products off the shelf. So the less that we're doing to advance these issues, not as what the Americans want, but what's good for Canada, the harder it becomes to arrive at a place that the public will accept any trade deal. Because if we're seen to be bending and capitulating to the will of the Americans because we've made an adjustment to our dairy marketing boards, then we can't, then that's now not touchable. And so many things become untouchable now because it's what the Americans want, when the reality is some of it is actually would be good for us too. And well, I think that it's great that, you know, Carney did the elbows up thing and he fought back and he defended our interests, because the reality is our auto sector wouldn't be competitive with what they were suggesting, if in fact that's what the suggestion was. And I'm going to take him at his word. But the reality is there is no pathway now for Canadians to even accept anything right now that we could negotiate with the Americans. And I think that that is a public relations challenge that needs to be managed sooner than later.
I'm not sure about that. I mean, if The Prime Minister hinted there were some provisions that threatened our sovereignty. I think Quebec is front and center because the supply management dairy thing is a sacred cow in Quebec. And by the way, he keeps saying he's on it, trying to get other markets. Other markets won't be thrilled about that either. So that's about Quebec. There were some, I don't know exactly what provisions, but that related to Quebec and the protection of the French language. So I don't know. So let us take a couple of calls. Let's go to Ted in Toronto. Hi, Ted.
Thank you for taking my call. I think what we have is an awareness problem with the U.S. I feel that they're not aware of the essentials that we provide to them, like Doug Ford pointed out, you know, the energy, the natural gas, the uranium, the potash, these are, especially potash, now that the Strait of Hormuz is closed, it's a higher premium. Uranium, you know, like we provide all these essentials to them. I think what we should impose is an awareness tariff for 2 weeks. All the essential items that they require, you add a 20% tariff for 2 weeks, not to be confrontational, just as an awareness tariff. And that would create a huge news frenzy in the U.S. and bring awareness to Americans and to Trump that we are essential for the U.S. We provide them with energy. We, you know, things keep ticking along because of the energy that we provide.
Okay. Okay, Ted, thanks for that. Let's hear from Sita in Mississauga. Hi, Sita.
Hi, Libby. Thank you so much. Trump and his staff thought that they can walk and take advantage of Canadians because we apologize and we're polite for everything. Cheers to our Prime Minister for walking away from a conniving deal that went wrong the last second. We'd even try to put back booze on the shelf. But at least he didn't give away Canada and our resources. We're not a state and we never will be. Thank you.
Thank you. A couple of things. So in the initial phase, a lot of the interpretations or the stuff that I saw, they put the blame completely on Howard Lutnick, the Commerce Secretary, walking into the room and trying to strong-arm more concessions. But I also understand that we tried to get more concessions as well, that maybe that came from Doug Ford. He wanted a better deal on auto than what was originally on offer. Lauren, do you have any insight into that?
No, but I think it's going to be a little hard to get an agreement right now because the public is pretty riled up. And there was even concern that the almost agreement wasn't that great in the first place. There was already concern that maybe that wasn't a good agreement, and then it got worse after that. So I think this is going to be difficult to sell to the public for the next little while, no matter what the agreement is. And people are now on high alert for a bad agreement.
Yeah.
So, sorry, Lauren, when you say little while, what kind of a timeline? Do you think that the original thought that there might be a two-week window, is that too short?
Probably in terms of public opinion, unless, I mean, the scrutiny on this next agreement is going to be tremendous. So everyone is on high alert. I don't see 2 weeks anything changing.
Bob, what do you think?
I think that there will be quiet conversations and some back channels to see if there's some way of putting Humpty Dumpty a bit back together here. I think I agree with Lauren. I think it's a very, very difficult environment now that it's gone nuclear publicly. So it makes it tough. It makes it tough for the president for the Americans to do stuff when the president keeps issuing ridiculous statements, and it makes it tough on the Prime Minister of Canada when everyone sees him as being tough and he's got 70 or 80% of Canadians supporting him. Any come down at all would be difficult to manage politically. So this is a tough one. I think the best we can do is to have a number of private conversations, private channels. Our new ambassador in place, knows a number of the senior people in the U.S. administration. I presume that he'll be working doing that, and as will others. But yeah, I suspect there won't be any big formal talks for a while.
Karen, do you agree? And what role do you think the midterms have? I thought it was interesting that in this latest threat from Donald Trump, he's talking about the new year, which is after the midterms.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've talked about this. I think part of the original strategy by the Canadians may have been to, you know, rag the puck until after the midterms in the hopes that there would be a bit of a shift in dynamic of power. But I mean, the hard part is that Trump doesn't really care. Like he runs by fiat. Like he signs these executive orders and puts them into place. And so he doesn't, whatever the outcome of the midterms are, I'm not sure that's going to change. That being said, I think that, you know, January 1 is a long time with President Trump. So I don't think we can rely on January 1 as any kind of milestone for anything. Like, you know, in between now and then is our window to do something. But what I don't see and what I don't know, smarter minds than mine are figuring it out, but, you know, how do we get Canadians to a place where they'd accept a deal? And I don't know how that happens.
Okay, we send a lot of energy to the United States. And remember, there was originally Doug Ford said, let's cut off the electricity. And Donald Trump had a fit and Doug Ford backed off. So, Bob, are we really able to cut that off? Because I think that the Prime Minister sort of hinted at that. And I'm thinking about Vance, the Vice President, sort of, again, insulting, boasting, saying, oh, Mark Carney tried to be tougher than Donald Trump. And I think that's what he was referring to. So is there a chance that we would actually do something like that?
I think it's highly unlikely. I think we're a different federation than the U.S. does. Our provinces have more control, particularly over natural resources. So they're a big player on this file. So I think it's more difficult to do that. But I think it's important for us to communicate better. This guy keeps saying that we don't need Canada. They need us, and so on and so forth. I think it's good to tell the people how much oil we're selling them, how much natural gas we're selling them, how important we are in terms of potash, particularly in the Midwest, on critical minerals, on a variety of other things. We're the 17th most important customer in 17 different states. So we actually are important to their economy, both from a consumer perspective and a supplier perspective. And I think more people need to know that. So these absolute, you know, when these rants happen that are fiction by the president, they don't take root, and people think that is in fact the reality of the situation.
Okay, and by the way, in a few minutes, in our second segment, we're going to be talking to a U.S. economist to get a real fix of what the damage is on their side of the border, in addition to our manufacturing segment. I've got a text here from Don in Hamilton, excuse me. So it's, why do Canadians take Mark Carney at his word? He lied about the Gordie Howe bridge deal, the Quebec outrage now explained over bilingual labeling. Is that the case? I hadn't seen that, Karen. Is it over bilingual labeling?
That was one of the items that was brought up as an issue that wasn't going to be resolved. I don't know if that was a last-minute issue or something they just couldn't nail down. So I don't actually know the status of that. What I do think it is important that Canadians understand what the terms of the deal on offer were, for just so that we know what did we turn down, and if this is where, you know, if this is our red line, then how do we demonstrate that we've actually got a better deal? And so I think that that's important for a lot of reasons and for transparency's sake. But I also think it is important that we calm the public sentiment down. Like, everyone is so angry, and you don't make good decisions when you're angry. No one does. No one does. And the reality is that as much as we are entitled to our anger, we also have an economy now. Our dollar is down. Again, we're back into this, not able to make decisions around the future because we don't actually know. Businesses don't know what the future looks like. Again, we also do have the benefit of the UMESCA, the United, did I say that correctly? Yeah. Like, most of our stuff is actually tariff-free, right? And so we're already in, like, thousands of jobs are being impacted, and most of our trade is actually free, continues to be free trade back and forth. And so what we're talking about is not at the margins, but it's not like the pain as bad as it's going to get is going to get a lot worse unless we can actually figure out a way to talk to each other. And so I see that the imperative for our government right now is to find a path forward where we can actually have a dialogue with Canadians about why we would want to go back and have a deal. Because right now, I believe that part of his ability to walk away was the fact that Wab Kanu and Doug Ford and others were saying, we don't like this deal, this is not a good deal. And that, you know, public polling in Quebec went soft when they heard about what was potentially going to happen to marketing. Yeah, I think the public probably wasn't going to accept this deal anyway. So it gave Mark Carney a permission to walk away from it. But as our leader, he's got to create the conditions where we can come back to the table.
Do you trust Carney, unlike Don from Hamilton? Karen.
I trust that he's wants to serve this country, and he, and in doing so, understands what's at stake here.
Lauren, I think a majority of Canadians do trust Mark Carney.
He's got the longest honeymoon in Canadian political history, and it's going to go on. And there's three federal by-elections coming up next Monday, and the Liberals, there's a long story behind each one of them, but the Liberals could well win all three of them. You know, the Conservatives are trying to put an end to the majority government, and these chances keep coming up. They hold one of those seats, the one in Quebec, and they could very well lose it, especially with what's going on down south.
Okay, let's take a call from Jody in Toronto. Hi, Jody.
Hi, Libby. With regard to Mr. Carney's decision to walk away from the deal, I'm not in a position to say whether it was a good thing to do or not. And I don't think I can do that until I see some proof as to what caused him to walk away. Now, I know what he's telling us, but we know from past experience that Mr. Carney seems to have a deficiency when it comes to truth-telling. So I'd like to see something in writing. One thing that comes to mind for me is Mexico. They're dealing with the same Trump as we are, the thin-skinned egomaniac, narcissist, whatever. And they've made such good progress in the last 18 months with their meetings, planned meetings, strategic meetings, and so on. And they're clipping along, whereas we in the 18 previous months have done nothing in this regard other than aggravating this man, where Mexico had the good sense not to do that.
Okay.
They didn't bow down to him, but they didn't aggravate him.
Okay, thank you for that. We only have a few minutes left. In the last segment of the show, we are going to be talking to Natalie Johnson, who is a candidate in the Beaches, East York. Before we go, Karen, you are a former city councillor. There were all these very last-minute switcheroos, some of which were set off by Paula Fletcher announcing that she's dropping out of the race 2 days after she registered. We had Diane Sachs, who is the councillor for University Rosedale, not wanting to go up against Mike Layton. They're both progressive. So what do you make about these switcheroos?
Well, you know, municipal politics is never boring. What I will say is that, we know name recognition preserves incumbencies for those running for re-election. We know that. And so, you know, when I think about the fact that there's going to be open seats, you know, Brad's seat is open, Paula Fletcher's seat was open. That was an opportunity for new blood to come in to City Hall with new ideas, fresh perspectives, next generation, all those things. And now we have more of the same, right? We've got Mike Layton coming in. We've got Diane Sachs switching wards. We've got now Nate Erskine-Smith. Like, so we don't have that opportunity for some renewal just evaporated because now we just have more of the same if they all win.
Do you see the hand of Progress Toronto in that?
Yes, I do. And I think it's really time that we call that for what it is, because it's operating without transparency, but it's creating an agenda and it's supporting candidates, and it's acting in a way that begs and demands accountability within that organization.
Well, it's like a Trump PAC. Bob, what's your view?
I agree. Progress Toronto is basically the downtown left NDP rebranded. That's what it is, and it's supported, I believe, by the public sector unions. I think it is too bad that we had not one but two women who would have been good counselors. One who has a 91.5% voting record with the mayor, Diane Sachs, and the other candidate is clearly a kind of moderate progressive candidate. Both of them have been shunted aside by guys who've been in politics for 10 years plus each, and frankly are back because they're bored. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that to me does not speak too well of Progress Toronto's goals for ensuring that there's more women serving in public office and so on and so forth. So anyways,
the second one?
Natalie Johnson is the first, and Diane Sachs is the other one.
Well,
who got sort of big-footed in University Roselle. And look, I know both of the men; they're good guys. And Nate did a good job as the MP in Beaches East York, and I think Mike Layton was a good city councillor. So it's not like they're terrible or anything like that. But it's what Karen said; it's more of the same.
Okay, well, and as I said, Natalie Johnson is in the house, and we'll be talking to her at 1:45. I'm looking at the clock. We're out of time. Thank you so much, Lauren Bozanoff, Bob Richardson, and Karen Stintz, and we'll talk again soon. Oh, boy. Maybe we'll have better news. Who knows? Right now, we're taking a break, and when we come back, we are going to drill down on exactly who is going to be hurt by the initial tariffs and the continued problems. So we have perspectives from both sides of the border when we return.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Oh, no. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. So what is the immediate damage from the tariffs that took effect this weekend? According to some estimates, they could cost up to 90,000 jobs. And these are jobs that are right in the center of the small business economy. Canadian Federation of Independent Business study says that 40% of small Canadian exporters will be directly hit, and nearly a third expect their revenues to drop by 50% or more. And I would also like to get a handle on what is the anticipated damage in the United States. So, people, if you want to weigh in on this, let me give the numbers out again. 866-744-740. And 416-360-0740. And now I'm joined by Corinne Pohlman, who is the Executive Vice President of Advocacy for the Canadian Federation of Independent Business, and Alfredo Carrillo Obregón, who is a trade policy analyst at the Cato Institute with a research focus on U.S. tariff policy. Thank you both for joining us. Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Okay. Well, let's start with you, Corinne. So who is going to be hurt immediately by this, in your opinion?
Well, certainly many small business owners, as you pointed out in your introduction, 40% of those that export to the United States are telling us that they would be directly hit. They are in anything from manufacturing to wood products to even arts, for example, people who have art that they send into the United States, jewelry makers. It's a very widespread list There was 18 pages of tariffs, over 300 and something tariffs that were listed. So it is going to have a broad impact on many different sectors of the economy.
And what is the size of these businesses? And again, how does it even trickle down to our retail here and consumers?
Yeah, I mean, the businesses are really of all sizes, right? A lot of them are small, right down to the individuals who make their own jewelry, for example, and send them to customers directly in the United States, like an online business. So an individual, all the way up to businesses that have manufacturing plants that may be doing very specific types of products that they then send to either, you know, corporate customers or individuals in the United States. So it's quite, again, spread out. And of course, what does this mean for consumers? Well, right now, those costs are going to be borne by Americans because these are U.S. tariffs. But Canada has said that they will retaliate starting September 8th, if nothing, of course, happens between now and September 8th. And those retaliatory tariffs will have an impact on Canadians and Canadian businesses because that's what we then have to pay when for products that are coming in from the United States.
Alfredo, we don't know much about the direct impact on Americans, and we keep seeing these tweets from the president in capital letters. We don't need Canada, they need us. So what's your view of who will be hit in the United States?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me. Well, we certainly do need Canada. Canada's our second largest source for imports here in the United States. And as Corinne mentioned, the list is widespread. It's, hard to necessarily pin down, exactly who will get hurt in its totality. But from what we can tell, there's a lot of wooden products. There's cement included. So you can imagine home builders getting hurt. There's consumer goods going from, whiskey and other alcohols imported from Canada to stuff like, cases for musical instruments, certain broadcasting and camera equipment. So consumers of these products could also get hurt. There are certain fabrics included in the tariff list. So certainly also inputs for industry over here. So because the list is widespread, the identities of the people or the companies that could bear the cost of these tariffs could also be widespread. Now, I should note that the tariffs cover only about 5% of total Canadian exports to the U.S. if we take 2025 import values as our year of reference. But this is just a sort of bird's eye view. It doesn't tell us. What we should note is that there are people who are going to bear these costs. And as I mentioned, the list is widespread, so we can definitely expect multiple people on the side of this border to bear those costs.
Now, we have a number saying even this current round, maybe a first round, which affects 5% of our trade, could cost 90,000 jobs. Is there any kind of estimate about what that could be in the United States?
I haven't seen an estimate. I think the part of the issue with sort of nailing down the impact of these tariffs is that, obviously 50% is a high number, and there are companies that are just, some of them are going to have to pay the tariffs and pass them down to consumers. Some, depending on the product, some of them will switch to other alternatives, and the cost of those alternatives compared to the products that are sourced from Canada is unclear. So I haven't seen an estimate is a short answer.
Corinne, I mean, part of the problem with this, a big part of the problem with this is the uncertainty it creates.
Absolutely. That's probably the number one issue, because as it was pointed out, it's only 5% of the exports going into the United States that are going to be affected directly by these tariffs. But it causes a huge amount of uncertainty. It will cause businesses to think twice about, well, do I make that investment now? Do I hire that extra person? Do I, expand the business the way I was thinking to the same degree? Or maybe I should wait it out just a little bit longer. And I think that's the bigger damage that can come with this, right? And so that's what we have to be aware of. And, if we do have retaliatory tariffs, if then the Americans retaliate on the retaliatory tariffs, all we can see is sort of where and how is this eventually going to end? And that's the really unstable part of all of this. And I think it will make a lot of businesses second guess where they're going to go next.
Your take on that, Alfredo?
No, I agree that uncertainty is probably the biggest cost, especially, again, for those businesses that are going to have to absorb the cost of the tariffs, because the tariffs, you know, the research that we have so far is it doesn't get passed down fully to the consumer. The businesses have borne a substantial share of these duties, the duties that have been previously imposed by the Trump administration. So in all likelihood, it'll be the same with this round. So certainly there will be the cost of uncertainty for those businesses. And I think bigger picture, I mean, we have to remember that these discussions and this dispute is happening against a backdrop where, you know, the Trump administration refused to agree to extend the United States-Mexico-Canada agreement, USMCA over here, CUSMA, north of the border. And, you know, the agreement is still in force for 10 more years, but unless those bilateral irritants between the United States and Canada are resolved, it seems unlikely that the Trump administration is going to sign off on extending that agreement. And, you know, businesses and large companies that plan ahead, certainly more, you know, for more than 10 years down the line, are also going to be second guessing their investments, at least on the margins.
Okay, let's take a call from David in Toronto. Hi, David.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My comment simply is that everyone seems really surprised at what's happening with the trade war. But this is the Americans for decades have only done what is best for them. And as they've continued to be sort of have their empire, they've gotten more and more aggressive. And so to me, Donald Trump is doing us a favor by forcing Canadians to diversify their markets. Like, it's never a good business plan to only have one customer for your product. But that's what a lot of Canadian companies have done in recent decades.
Thanks for that. And let me read a text. No name on this one. Hi, I'm late to the table on the trade fiasco, but my take is bully Trump will make it harder for Canada to get a deal. Oh, yeah. I like Mexico because, unlike Mexico, he wants our natural resources and he is after Greenland and we will not assist him in surrendering either of those two items. I don't know that we could give him Greenland even. If we wanted to. And yes, U.S. tariffs date back, the act is from 1930, I believe. Yes, I'm correct on that. Anyway, I'm sure that we will have a lot more to talk about on these notes. Thank you so much, Corinne Pullman and Alfredo Carrillo Obregón. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you.
Okay. We are taking another break, and when we come back, Natalie Johnson is in the house. She is a veteran or a reporter, decided to run for office in her ward in the Beaches, East York. She's been working really hard. She's been knocking on doors, wants to see some change, and then, boy, Naderskin Smith comes plowing back in. We'll talk to her after the break.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, now to the upcoming municipal elections, which many Torontonians are hoping will bring change and will bring an end to the city's decline. Well, in the days leading up to the Friday deadline for registering, there were a bunch of switcheroos, which actually seemed quite cynical. One of them was in the Beaches, East York, where Natalie Johnson, a veteran CTV News political journalist, has put her name forward and has been working for months. Natalie joins me now. Thank you so much for coming in.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Okay. Now, the first thing I want to get into, so you are on a leave of absence, but this is one of the things that are very hard for people who work and make a living. Even if you get a leave of absence, you're not going to be making money while you're running for office. And often, you know, people, you're on the hook for the money your campaign spends if you don't raise all that money. So this is not an easy thing to do.
Yeah, it's certainly not an easy thing to do. And I think that indicates that I really have been all in on this from the start. This was a conversation with my husband. We have three young sons who are in daycare. We have a mortgage. There is a real financial cost to taking an unpaid leave of absence from my job. But it indicated my desire from the start that I was very serious about doing this. I walked away from a dream job in order to pursue making a more direct difference in my own community.
Okay, and before we get to why, another part of that. So if you had a journalism job like mine, where I'm allowed to have opinions and commentate, that's one thing. But you were reporting from City Hall, and after running, I don't think you can go back to doing that. So that's another bit of uncertainty. Yeah,
I absolutely agree. I do think that once you make the decision to go into politics yourself, you can't then go back to commenting on politics as an objective journalist. And so that was all part of the calculation for me in deciding whether I wanted to do this, because I have always loved City Hall. It has been my passion and my priority as a journalist for the last 16 years. I have been down there 5 days a week since David Miller was mayor, following all of the issues that have shaped this city. And it was really in pursuit of making a more direct difference in Beaches, East York, where I'm raising my family with my husband, that, you know, went into this decision to me, not one I took lightly, that if this is something where I can actually work to move the needle on issues affecting us locally, it's a big decision for me, and it was.
And so what are some of the local issues that are moving you?
One of the things that I think is a big priority in Beaches, East York is getting the East End moving again. I would argue it has never been more difficult to access the rest of the city. And a lot of that, frankly, happened overnight about 5 years ago when the Gardner ramp down to the lakeshore to the east end of the city was removed. Now, this was done as part of a broader realignment and revitalization of the Gardner. And there is a bigger plan at play there, which needs to be done. But when that ramp came down, it really disconnected the East End's access to the west side of the city, to the downtown core, and even to some degree to the north end. And it, in many cases, more than doubled commute times for people. I have been at the door now talking to residents for 4 months, and door after door, people are saying, look, you know, my adult children and my grandchildren who live in Etobicoke used to come for Sunday night dinner every single week. Now we're lucky if it's once a month, because people are just finding that, you know, the tax on their time ultimately has skyrocketed. And so what I'm calling for on that is for the city to make it a political priority to rebuild that ramp and to restore the way that we can move around the city. And I also believe this needs to be done in tandem with improvements to transit, because that is a huge piece of the mobility puzzle. And we live single digit kilometers away from the downtown core. That is part of the beauty of living in the Beach and in East York, is that we are so close to so many of the wonderful things the city has to offer, and yet we've never been further away.
Well, exactly. I mean, we have friends in Beaches, and we don't go there. I can't think of the last time. It just takes too long. I live in Midtown. And, you know, I really applaud your focus on really local issues that is so sadly lacking. I can tell you, I'm on my residents association, and Josh Matlow is our counselor, and I see him always getting up and opining on things that city council has no say on. But, you know, you want to talk about a traffic light, stop sign, boring things. So, you know, I think we have gone so far losing the practical things that city council should be dealing with.
And that is why I have always been so passionate about the local level of government, because you really can move the needle on these issues. When I'm going to the door and people, to your point, are saying, look, there's a lot of aggressive drivers now cutting through my residential side street because of the traffic on the main arterials, what can we do in terms of physical improvements to the way the infrastructure is built to slow down drivers, be it improving sight lines, you know, remedying curb extensions, adding speed humps. These are things that city council can do, and they can do them relatively easily, right? You just need a bit of political will. And that to me indicative of the impact that local government can have on everyday life for people, because life is local. It is what you touch and feel when you walk outside of your front door. If your bus does not show up on time, that is City Hall. If you take your kids to the local park and the bathrooms are locked up or the water fountains don't work, that is City Hall. If the streets are dirty and, you know, you're starting to lose some civic pride in your neighborhood, that's City Hall.
Yeah, I mean, it is, these are the practical things. Now, even those things you mentioned, you know, City Hall seems to be seized with ideology. And when it comes to things that affect congestion and driving, they seem to be driven by ideology, not just some kind of, you know, inertia.
Yeah, and enough of the culture wars, right? I do believe that people in this city, in Beaches East York especially, are going to be using different levels of transportation, different modes of transportation as part of their everyday life. And look, I'm a mom of three young boys who play hockey. The reality is when they have a hockey game in the west end of the city, we are going to be loading our family of five into a minivan and driving with their hockey bags out to Weston. And that is not something that we are going to be doing on our bicycle. And there are people who also like to use our bike lanes, and there are people who want to use public transit. And these are all important pieces of the puzzle. But instead of having it be car versus bike lane or car versus TTC, let's work to create solutions for all of our road users, because I do think that far too long we've been too casual about the use of our roads. We don't have enough strategic forethought on what goes where. We cannot have on every single road streetcars and street parking and construction and cafe TO patios and then say, well, why isn't traffic moving, right? We need to have a bigger picture view of how people can get around in this city, because certainly in the East End, it has never been more difficult.
Now, where do you stand on Brad Bradford? I think you're supporting him.
I'm not weighing into the mayoral campaign. Yeah. And the reason for that is I do believe that in order to be effective locally as a councillor, for me between Coxwell and Vic Park, and that is my focus, you need to be able to work with whoever has the balance of power. And here's an example of that. One of the big things that I'd like to do for Beaches East York is build back that Gardner ramp. If I walk into City Hall as an elected official and I have already made enemies out of the rest of council, well, guess what? I'm one vote of 25 councillors. And so I have said this entire time, my focus is on Beaches East York. That's who I'm there to represent. I will act on behalf of the constituents. And this is not about associating myself with a political party, because to me, that is also the beauty of City Hall. And I do understand, you know, that these party structures and these voting blocks are at play. I've covered City Hall for 16 years. I see that in action. But, you know, the beauty of it is that you can actually listen to people. And going door to door for the last 4 months, talking to people about the issues, you see that there are themes and there are trends there. I do believe that we are paying enough in taxes at this point, given that we have seen a 25% increase in services over the last 4 years. I'm hearing that we're at a breaking point for affordability for homeowners, and they'd like to see more value pulled out of those tax dollars. So you can say, sure, that's ideologically aligned with a certain party. But I also think that other parts of my platform may be more ideologically aligned. You know, with environmental causes, preserving the waterfront, you know, in this battle over the expansion of the Island Airport is another example. And so as much as people may want to put me in a box politically, I'm here to represent the constituents of Beaches East York.
Okay, let's get to Nate Erskine-Smith. I mean, watching him switch around over the last number of months, he was a cabinet minister for a very short period of time, and a very sore loser when he was ousted from cabinet. He was not happy about it. Then he decided he was the person to become the leader of the Ontario Liberal Party. He couldn't get the nomination. Again, he challenged that result. And now he's back trying to run for city council.
What I would say to that is that City Hall is not a backup plan. It should not be a consolation prize for a higher level of government in a different part of the city. And this campaign has been underway for 4 months now. I have made clear from the very start of this campaign that City Hall is my first priority. It always was as a journalist. As I said, I do think it is the level of government where you can make the most impact on day-to-day lives of residents. But, you know, I don't think that the residents of Beaches East York want to be taken for granted here. And I think it's unfortunate when someone circles back to City Hall as a consolation prize because they weren't successful at a different level of government in a different part of the city.
And he's is he having some kind of federal pension, or what's his situation?
Well, I do know that, you know, he was actively the Member of Parliament for Beaches East York at the start of this municipal campaign while he was actively seeking a seat at the provincial level in Scarborough Southwest. And so, you know, you mentioned that I'm on an unpaid leave of absence from a private corporation in which to undertake this campaign. During the same municipal campaign period, my opponent was getting paid by taxpayers to act as the MP, even though he was looking for a job in a different part of the city at a different level of government. And this was all during the same campaign period that is currently underway for the City Hall election for Beaches East York.
So why do you think, I mean, this, the, what I hear from people who are more familiar with your area is that, oh, he's got that one sewn up. I mean...
Well, look, you know, we heard Karen Stintz earlier on your show say that the power of incumbency is so strong. And I do appreciate that. I've covered enough elections in the course of my career as a political reporter to understand that name recognition is, often an immovable force in these elections. But I have a four-month head start on Nate. I have been talking to thousands of residents of this ward for 4 months now. But beyond that, I have my own role and my own involvement in our community. Not only do I have my own record and resume as a political reporter and somebody who has command of the files municipally, and I do, for what it's worth, think that City Hall is a very different level of government. And just because you have served at the federal level does not mean you understand the nuance of City Hall or frankly care about the issues that can be as mundane as filling potholes. But I am raising my family.
That's a big deal.
Exactly.
That is a big deal. And you have one of the most veteran councils, Mike Cole, drives around with a shovel, and that's why he's been in so long.
Yeah, and you know, it is my pledge to voters that this is what I care about, and this is why I like the city level. But look, this is also my home. It's my community. I have three sons with my husband in Beaches East York, and my entire family has been involved in the ward for 10 years now. I'm on the board of Centre 55, a fantastic community centre locally, along with the Beaches Sandbox, and a lot of local organizations and registered charities that have done a lot of good work within our community. And so, sure, name recognition is important, but people in Beaches East York also know me both for my community involvement, my work as a journalist, and now, the work that our campaign is undertaking to represent the people of Beaches East York.
Okay, last 30 seconds, what do you want to leave us with?
What I'm asking voters here is to take a look at the decision that is before them. The fact that City Hall should not be a consolation prize, that I've been here for Beaches East York for this council seat specifically since the very beginning of this campaign. I have spoken to so many of them over the course of this campaign period, and the response, I will say, has been very positive all along. Our campaign has excellent momentum. We are working to represent the interests of the people, and it is not as a backup plan. It has always been my priority and my passion, and I hope that we can work together to be successful and represent Beaches East York at the City Hall level.
Okay, and you certainly know how 30 seconds is 30 seconds. Natalie Johnson, good luck to you, and thanks so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks, Libby.
Okay, well, that's all the time we have for today. Follow us on YouTube, follow us on Instagram. I'll be back here tomorrow, and we'll talk then.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.